Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides Podcast. This is the show where we talk about the art of collaboration and bringing out the best in each other. Our guest today is Phil Klei. He wrote the book Redeployment, winner of the National Book Award for Fiction in 2014. He's also a Marine who was deployed in Iraq during the 2007-2008 period around the Anbar region. His book is a collection of fictional short stories told from different perspectives of those who served during the Iraq and Afghan wars. It's similar in style to Tim O'Brien's classic compilation of stories from Vietnam, The Things They Carried. In this episode, we discuss Phil's book, Redeployment, and we also talk about the war genre in general, its conventions, and the way it influences how we think about war. Sometimes war is messy and ugly and leads to unnecessary desolation, but also a search for higher meaning and even heroism. And every successful civilization throughout recorded history has had to wrestle with war and how to handle it. We talk about the light and dark sides of war and some of the complexities in our discussion. Coming up next, stick around.
This is the N. Savvides Podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the N. Savvides Podcast, Phil Klei.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
By way of introduction, tell us about how you describe your book, Redeployment, and what prompted you to write it.
So it's a book of 12 short stories, all the narrators spent time in Iraq in some capacity. They're all different. There's an infantryman, a foreign service officer, a chaplain, a psychological operations specialist. What prompted me to write it was really all the questions that I had about the war coming back from Iraq. Actually, I served in Iraq in 2007-2008, and spent a lot of time thinking about the Iraq war more generally, about, kind of what America looks like when people get home. And that's what I worked on for the next 4.5 years.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't realize it was 4.5 years of writing or reflecting and getting to the point where you can write about it.
Yeah, the first story I started in 2008, a couple of months after I got back from Iraq, and finished it in 2013.
Reading some of the things you've said in some of the other pieces you've written and the interviews you've had, I get a sense that you were facing certain frustrations with some of the things that people said to you, one of them being the question, have you ever killed anyone? Or the thing where someone would say to you, I could never imagine what you've been through. So talk about some of those frustrations and maybe other things not to say to veterans who have fought.
It's not just frustrations with things that you'll encounter in the civilian community. There's also frustrations with things that you'll encounter in the veteran community as well. I think that there are all these kind of ways that we choose to think about war and talk about war. And there's also just a lot of kind of political weight that is often present in the conversation about war. I mean, the real thing in terms of what to say or what not to say to a veteran is just to go in without a ton of preconceived notions, because the experience can be so different for different people, and their ways of approaching it and thinking about it might be very different.
I've run into some veterans who appreciate the question, thank you for your service, and then I think there are others who don't appreciate it as much. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've always appreciated it. I think sometimes the fear, or I think part of the worry is among some veterans, what exactly is this person thanking me for? There's a character in the book who mentions that he was a mortuary affairs specialist and talks about being thanked for his service, and wondering if people had any idea what exactly that entailed for him. It's certainly better than a lot of the reactions that people talk about getting back from Vietnam. I think we're as a culture trying to figure out a way to deal with veterans and to think about veterans, and just the phrase is a kind of a ritual. At the very least, it's a kind of ground line of respect and emphasis on the fact that it's service. I think that the worry is that that's where it stops, right? I think there's something very strange about being in a war zone, being in a place where, you know, there's a lot of suffering, right? And then coming back to a country that really doesn't feel like a nation at war, that oftentimes doesn't feel like it's thinking very seriously or talking very seriously about the war, and yet, you know, the political decisions that we make here have huge consequences overseas. If thank you for your service doesn't go beyond that, I think that's sometimes the worry, that that's the end of the transaction.
Right, so it's a good starting point, but ideally it goes beyond just that.
Right, I think that, you know, sort of a recognition of the role that we all, kind of veteran and civilian alike, have and responsibility that we have towards the war policy that's been done in our name is important.
Now, throughout your book, I notice a recurring interest in not just the war, but in the kinds of stories that people tell about the war. And there seems to be some ambivalence there. In War Stories, one of the short stories of your book, there's the playwright who is trying to tie everything to PTSD. In another story, they're getting compared to a Call of Duty game. And yeah. Even the stories that some of the soldiers tell about their experience is not quite like the experience itself. So I was wondering if you would care to elaborate on how you see the role of stories in helping us understand the war experience.
I think it's complicated, right? Because you go to war with all the stories about war that you've got rattling around in your head. You try and, you know, use those stories to make sense of what's happening around you. And then you come back home to all the stories about war that the culture's telling itself. So, you know, there's a bit in Karl Marlantes's What It's Like to Go to War, where he says, ask the 20-year-old combat veteran at the gas station what it feels like to kill a man, and his probable angry answer, if he's being honest, is it doesn't feel like a f***ing thing. He says, you know, if you ask that same veteran the same question 40 years later, you might get a very different response. And the thing is, you'll get a different response, not just based on who that veteran is or what they experience, but also based on the community that he had around him. And that community is going to be shaped by story. The difficulty that the people often have in a lot of my stories, I think, is they're trying to share what they've been through to people who often have fixed notions of what the Iraq War was or what it means or what service means. And at the same time, the veterans themselves sometimes are not sure what to make of their experience. You know, when you're inside something, it's hard to get perspective on it. I mean, that's why we talk things out with our friends. You know, that's why when you're in a bad relationship, you go to your wise buddy and ask him, you know, tell him what's going on, and you know, he'll tell you, all right, well, you know, you're kind of being a jerk here, or, you know, whatever. But with war experience, it's often something very intense, very, very wrapped up in that person's identity, their sense of their self. It can be, you know, it just can be a hard thing to talk about. Sometimes it involves, you know, difficult or painful memories. So how you talk about that, and then, you know, what kind of person you're talking to about the war can matter a lot. And that, you know, that gets dramatized in different ways in the book.
I was hoping to talk now a little bit more about the war story as a kind of genre in literature or film. And the way I see it, this is a simplification here, but I see three main kinds of stories, right? There's the war is futile and or madness, like, say, All Quiet on the Western Front, Catch-22, Dr. Strangelove. Then there's The Heart of Darkness, say, Apocalypse Now, I think, suggests that. And then there's the strand where war is tough, but it brings out the best in some, like, say, Braveheart, Sergeant York, or maybe a Steven Spielberg film. So I was wondering how you think about it. Are there other breakdowns? Are there other kinds of stories? And if you have thoughts on those different strands of the war story.
You know, I mean, war stories are pretty pretty rich and varied, right? I mean, I think, you know, also you're talking about war stories where the protagonist is a veteran, war stories where the protagonist is a civilian. You know, war is a big topic. And it's I think you've got as many different types of What experiences in war do you have in any other, you know, kind of major realm of human behavior?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex topic. I didn't mean to simplify it. It's just, it's helpful to me to get general categories, but I don't think they're all going to fall neatly into one or the other. All right, well, I want to take a moment to pause the discussion and hear from our sponsor, the Louisiana Film Prize. That's the festival that happens in Northwest Louisiana. Winner of that festival gets $50,000 in cash. Gregory Kallenberg, the executive director of the festival, is here to tell us about the community they try to encourage.
My background is filmmaking, and I've had the fortunate experience of going to, you know, some really big festivals like South by Southwest. And I think that what I wanted to create was kind of the antithesis of all that. I mean, I wanted to really smash together the filmmaker, the audience, and the judge so that they were all watching the films together and they were all walking the streets together. And I think that what that has done is create a nationally unique energy that that the film prize has forged. I mean, it's when you're able to see these people interact on the street during film prize weekend, I mean, it's like a big family getting together. It's even translated to the point where at the top 20 brunch where we give away the 50,000, it's like watching kids having to leave camp and go home again. I mean, there are people crying and trading numbers and making sure that they stay in touch. And that's how you create something special, is you create those bonds and you create that energy that we all make collectively. And I think we've been able to do it so far.
All right. So it's quite an experience, and it's not too late to submit a film. Deadline's coming up close, but you still have some time if you get on it. Visit LAFilmPrize.com to learn more about the festival and how you can get involved. Now back to our discussion with Phil Klei. You did mention something that I was also going to ask about, which is whether a story can be considered a war story, even if it doesn't necessarily involve soldiers, like, say, Schindler's List or Casablanca.
What about a story like Andrea Barrett's The Ether of Space, which is a fantastic story, which is about, it's a woman going to a lecture by a famed scientist who's one of the critics of Einstein and very invested in the theory of scientific theory of ether. And as she's going to this lecture, she realizes that one of the things that's tying him to this old scientific paradigm is the way that paradigm, he, you know, relates to certain occult beliefs that he has, or that he adopted after World War I, after the death of his son. There's no war in the story. None of the characters are combatants. But the, you know, central drama of the story is determined by the feelings of loss and grief that people have after a war. It's a really powerful exploration of that. There's a novel by an Egyptian novelist, Wagyu Ghali, called Beer in the Snooker Club. It's a great book. In the middle section of that book, you have these two Egyptians from upper-class families. They take a trip to London, and they meet this British soldier who served in the Suez Crisis. And he's very excited to meet Egyptians because he was just there and doesn't, you know, quite realize why this might be a sort of more fraught encounter than he thinks it is. And it's this kind of very interesting and very funny and very painful description of the, you know, them going out and getting a drink together. You know, that strikes me as having a lot to say about war as well, for obvious reasons, but it's not, certainly not a traditional war story in any way.
In your New York Times article, or in one of them, you talk about how a film like Saving Private Ryan and the books by Stephen Ambrose helped to shift the way the public sees war, thinks about war, at least in comparison to Vietnam. And so I was wondering your thoughts on how the current war stories influence our thoughts on war, and maybe even how you hope your own book will influence that discussion.
Well, I certainly hope that it makes it a more complicated discussion, right? You know, there are certain types of narratives that you see in the broader public. I've written a little bit about this. A lot of discussion of war focuses on trauma, right? Which is an important topic. But I think that, you know, the experiences that people have in that are broader. I think one of the things that people are often surprised to find out veterans of Iraq, when they do polls, oftentimes are very critical of Iraq war policy, but most of them say that, I think it's something like over 90% say that if they had to do it all over again, they would. So, yeah, just a kind of more complex look at war, and also war is sort of this broad, you know, broader kind of process, not just like a, you know, sort of stories of individual heroes making outsized impacts, but a huge organization, you know, war is an industrial scale process, and with a lot of different, you know, moving parts and roles that are important for what happened.
On the note of telling a more complex narrative, I will say that your book to me feels like a companion piece to Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. Again, that one is also very interested in not just the war, but the kinds of stories we tell and how we sometimes want this simplified version and it's more complex than that.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book. Very funny. And that is very much about the sort of way that war narratives fit into, you know, our kind of political and commercial culture, just a kind of brilliant intersection of sports and commerce and advertising and war and politics, all in that one place that he establishes in that book. Fantastic book.
He actually gave you a pretty nice quote about your book. And one of the things that was striking to me was he concluded his quote by saying that your book gives him a reason to hope. Hopeful wouldn't be the first word that I would think of to describe your book. I would say thoughtful, bittersweet, contemplative, but it was striking that he felt that way. And I think part of it is that maybe he felt encouraged that someone was getting across the kinds of complicated, hard to express feelings that aren't normally part of the discussion.
Maybe, you know, whenever I read, you know, there's a lot more literature being written by Iraq and Afghan vets. And, you know, there's Elliot Ackerman's Green on Blue just recently came out, which is a novel told from the perspective of an Afghan boy turned soldier. It's a very interesting book. There's Chris Robinson and Gavin Kovite co-wrote a book called The War of the Encyclopedists. It's a very wild, very funny novel. You know, every time I read something that gets at different aspects of the experience that I really want expressed, it's incredibly gratifying, actually. You know, there's a book by, you know, Jeff Dyer, wrote a book called Another Great Day at Sea, which is just, he, you know, he spent time on an aircraft carrier. And it's not a war book, really, in any way. It's just more about the military organization. But And the appeal of being in the military, really, and, you know, about a lot of the people that he meets there and the different jobs that folks do. And that was very gratifying for me to read, you know, just to have somebody articulate that so well. The things that we pay the most attention to are often the most disturbing or things, but a veteran's reaction to the more awful things that they might experience are often going to be mediated by how they feel about their service in general and the kind of deep appeals of it. So, you know, anything that helps advance understanding of the subject I does give me cause to hope, and very much, you know, I always feel gratified whenever I read something that nails it.
On the other side of that, are there frustrations you have about certain kinds of war stories or things you wish certain people, certain storytellers would do better when it comes to war stories?
I mean, sure. You know, after the second Fort Hood shooting, for example, there was a slew of kind of irresponsible articles about PTSD, suggesting that it was, you know, the shooter probably did it because they had PTSD. You know, people don't do premeditated acts of murder because of PTSD. That's not part of the condition. And, you know, there was like I think it was the Huffington Post had a, you know, the deadly aftermath of war, and there was a map of all the murders, you know, committed by veterans. And it, you know, if you look at the map, it looks like there's this kind of wave of veteran violence. But, you know, if you look at the numbers, you realize that there's no evidence that veterans are overrepresented in the prison population. I think the last survey of the prison population, they had veterans were underrepresented. It's easy, because people don't have a lot of experience with the thing, to kind of create these excitable false notions, particularly in the wake of something as extreme as that.
Yeah, I mean, there is that negative stereotype about the crazed soldier, which strikes me as exceedingly unfair and overrepresented in a lot of the stories out there.
Yeah, exactly.
The parts of your book that I connected to the most were the religious undertones. There's a passage in particular in Prayer in a Furnace. Let me read the quote. You have the priest saying, "Sin is a lonely thing. A worm wraps around the soul, shielding it from love, from joy, from communion with fellow man and with God." And like other moments that your religious characters have, I thought it was a poignant moment, and it made some of the more abrasive aspects of the stories more bearable. So I was wondering if you would care to elaborate on that passage, or just some of the recurring spiritual aspects of your stories.
Well, I've always been a huge fan of Catholic literature, and actually, that right after that passage, he quotes Georges Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest, which is a wonderful book. And certainly, you know, writers like Graham Greene, Shusaku Endo, Francois Mauriac, very important to me. You know, in terms of what do we do with suffering? What do we make of it? How do we avoid simply retreating into ourselves and bitterness? The religious characters have a language and the kind of intellectual tools to counter those notions.
You also mention St. Augustine in the book. Do you
Yes.
buy into his notion of a just war?
Yeah, I mean, I'm basically on board with a classic just war theory. You know, complicated feelings about it, but sure. Yeah, I do think there's the possibility of just war.
Someone else who is of influence to you is Leo Tolstoy. And in War and Peace in particular, you get a sense of sweeping providence and something bigger unfolding. Were there moments like that for you in your experience in Iraq, or did it feel like it was really hard to see the bigger picture and it was more chaos than anything else?
Well, I mean, because of the role that I was doing as a staff officer, I had a better ability to think about the sort of broader changes that were happening in the province. You know, I got to travel around a lot. I got to sit in on the, you know, battle update assessment briefs. I went to General Odierno from time to time. I sat in on the general's briefings every morning. So the war over the course of a year, particularly during the surge, when things were really changing in Anbar province, there certainly was a sense of a kind of broader purpose behind what we were doing. It didn't feel like a kind of sequence of Groundhog Day, one day after the other, and, you know, no change happened.
Right. So you saw some progress.
Right. Yeah. Anbar was very violent early in 2007, and that changed. The violence went down a lot by the end.
All right. That's an encouraging thing.
Well, and of course, you know, now it's totally chaotic again, and you've got the rise of ISIS, so that didn't last. But yeah, certainly during the time that I was there, we saw that.
Since you brought up ISIS, do you have any thoughts about an appropriate response to them?
The biggest thing for me is, if we're going to have a policy against ISIS or kind of have a robust military response, I really would like there to be more of a public debate. It's problematic when Congress sort of sees all oversight, and you know, I know Obama has asked for an authorization of military force. It doesn't look like they're going to do it. It's we're already engaged anyway. But I really do wish that there was more of a public debate, more pressure on politicians from the American people for them to just take a position. I don't think it's a good thing when you're sending people overseas, when you're using military force without a strategy that's been clearly articulated and argued before, argued over in front of the American people. And I don't really feel like we have that right now. And so that's a problem. I think that's a problem for military policy and our hopes of having it be sort of, you know, tempered and tested and good and thoughtful and hopefully, you know, with an eye towards a broader strategy. During the surge, there was a lot of kind of congressional interest in the policy that we were doing, and you know, there were serious challenges to it. I mean, there are complicated things about that too, but at the very least, it was a major political issue, what war policy was going to be.
That ties into some of the media that is created in context of the war. You know, some might call that propaganda or information campaigns. I guess that's something that you were doing as a public affairs officer. And it was striking to me that the most abrasive story, for me anyway, was psychological operations. And that one is also about propaganda, I guess, the stories that some were telling to the Iraqis.
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, that narrator is angry about a lot of things, and some of the things he talks about are pretty pretty abrasive, sure.
I would say of all the stories, that one felt to me the most like the Heart of Darkness kind of thing, like look at the kinds of awful things that even the supposed good guys can do. I wonder about this sometimes, like, on the one hand, there's something to be said about honest acknowledging the truth of the situation, some of the darkness that people faced or exhibited. But then on the other hand, I think sometimes seeing the truth of the thing can have a corrupting influence.
I mean, it depends on how you approach it, I think. I mean, there are really worse things in other stories. It's not that he's doing anything so terrible compared to other types of things that happen in war. It's just that, you know, his war stories are very different. And the way that he was a combatant is very different. You know, the sort of effects that he got on a battlefield, he got through, well, I mean, basically using words, right? He talks about, you know, how language is a technology, right? And he's very skilled at manipulation, how to use language. And he uses that actually in his civilian life as well, at college. But he's interested in having a real conversation with this woman. He thinks it's this kind of complicated seesawing that happens, I think, with him and his relationship to the war, right? It's interesting that you feel like it's so awful. You know, at one point he talks about how his father would have been so much more proud of him if he just, you know, shot somebody in the face, right?
Yeah.
That we're much more comfortable with that action than the sorts of things that he does, even though, you know, it's aimed at the same effect, right? Which is, you know, killing the enemy.
Yeah. So more specifically, it was like the explicit things that he was saying and that you were conveying in that story of like just how explicit he was, and maybe people you heard doing similar things were. I mean, it's pretty profane and irreverent, disrespectful of the religion.
You know, they're doing taunts, right? So it's in the first Battle of Fallujah. They, you know, there are bits where the Marines would compete to come up with the dirtiest insults, and then he'd get on the loudspeakers and insult the various groups that they're fighting against in that city, and try and, you know, piss them off, basically, and get them to charge. And that was something that happened. It was a scatological warfare, they called it. And one of the things that he knows is he sort of understands the culture a little better than the Marines do, so he knows how to offend them more and get under their skin.
Let me try to explain what I'm getting at in a slightly different way. I think some more ancient cultures had reservations about always conveying the truth of the thing in explicit detail, right? Like there's the story of Medusa in Greek mythology, right? Like something could be so horrible that seeing it could turn someone to stone, you know, literally or figuratively. And I think even our storytelling traditions in the 30s or 40s, we had this sensibility of trying to broach an issue without exposing someone to all the corruption at hand. And we've moved away from that a little bit now in our modern storytelling, where we feel like, hey, this let's give it the full realism.
So I had somebody ask me if I thought that my book would be appropriate for high school seniors, right? And I kind of thought to myself, well, I certainly hope so, because they could be experiencing these things for real in a year. There's a lot of profanity in the book. There's a lot of very ugly things in the book, for sure. Reading a book is a pretty safe way to experience the ugliness in the world.
Yeah, and I agree. I don't think we should whitewash it. I mean, it's a fine line. I totally understand the heart of darkness aspect of things. It's one reason why I am hesitant to use profanity. It's not that I don't swear. It's just that I try not to, because I've noticed the effect that profanity can have on me. It can make me more inclined to go to anger or go toward something darker.
This is a question I always had for myself writing the book, right? Like, if I'm going to show something shocking or talk about something grotesque, am I doing it just for the shock value in war stories, right? That's part of the concern there. Are we interested in Jenks as Jenks, or are we just interested in him because of what happened to him in the horror? And I think that's always a question that you have to ask. If you're going to put that sort of stuff in there, is it just for titillation? And if it is, then that's a problem. I certainly, you know, would agree with you there.
And it's a complicated topic, because I do acknowledge that it's important to address the truth of the thing and not make it seem like it's just a pristine thing. You know, there's certainly value. It's just, I'm conflicted about it, I guess. What kinds of things would you say go too far or are not appropriate or beneficial to include? Or is there such a thing?
Anything that's just for shock value. But if you write war stories and they don't make the reader uncomfortable, I think you've failed.
Would you care to elaborate?
If you're talking about war, you're talking about industrial scale killing of the human beings, right? And you're talking about a lot of the things that happen within, you know, an organization that's involved in that. It can't be all dark, right? I think cynicism is its own kind of failure, right? And there is, you know, true heroism and good people in war, and it's very important that we understand that and think about it. But if you just kind of whitewash the subject and make it kind of easily digestible for the reader, that you're lying to them and you're not talking about the sorts of things that really happen. And that's not good for us as a country that needs to be able to have some sort of understanding of war, because we're a country that uses military force all the time. It's not good for veterans, right? I met a veteran of World War II. He hates the idea of the greatest generation, right? You know, he told me, war ruined my life. You know, this is the good war, the war we're all supposed to feel great about, but he, you know, his personal experience, his relationship to it is very different. And that, you know, avoiding that ugliness and in talking about those stories, I mean, it makes us feel better about it talking to him, but it doesn't make him feel better. I think that it's important to deal with all facets of the war experience. I agree, if you just go too dark, if there's no hope, if there's only insanity, I mean, that's its own kind of easily digestible thing, right? You know, a war story where, oh yeah, you know, Marines go to Iraq and they're just murdering civilians left and right, and, you know, everybody's a callous, evil person, right? Like, that's not troubling to an audience either. It's just awfulness, and it's a simplistic portrait of reality that we can easily kind of pick up and discard and not have to think about.
So it should have all the complexities that war can bring.
Exactly.
All right. Well, a film like American Sniper, it is now the most successful war film, I believe, as far as the returns it got. Did you have a reaction to it as a war story?
I thought in many ways the reaction to American Sniper was more interesting than the ways in which, you know, you had, like, you know, people attacking Chris Kyle or, you know, sort of holding him up as the, you know, paragon of the American military man. I mean, it was a very sort of polarized reaction to the film, which I think has a lot to do with the way that we still don't know how to think about veterans. And, you know, the film was did some things well. It was limited in other ways, particularly, you know, in depiction of Iraqis. But, you know, it was what it was. Hopefully we'll have, you know, just more war stories that continue to complicate that portrait.
I wouldn't say it's the end all be all, but I did appreciate that it spent a good part of the story in dealing with the soldier coming back from war.
Yes, absolutely. I thought those were good.
And it seemed like there was some complexity to him. It seemed like the war did take its toll. And I heard some interesting conversations that came from it where people were talking about it and trying to reflect on the impact of war. All right. So it sounds like a mixed reaction for you. This one is a bit out there, but I was wondering, do you know the writer Terry Brooks?
No.
Okay, so he writes fantasy, and he did a series called The Dark Legacy of Shannara. This is not the kind of book that is typically associated with the war story, but I think you can read it as a kind of metaphor for Iraq without the political associations that come with it. And it was actually a thoughtful thing for me to get exposed to an Iraq-like scenario outside of the particulars of the war itself. So I was wondering if there are instances like that where it's beneficial to get a war discussion from something that isn't associated with all the politics that come with war.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, anything that kind of alienates us from the subject can be sometimes useful.
On a more personal note, you were discussing earlier how 90% of the veterans would go back if they could, or would at least re-experience it if given the choice. Would you say the same if given the choice, knowing what you know now, would you still go back and participate?
Absolutely, I would.
We were talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, but an idea that I came across recently in doing some research on it is the idea of post-traumatic growth, which is sort of along those lines.
Yeah, I think that a lot of veterans feel like they are better, stronger for the experience. I think oftentimes the transition out of the military can be a sort of difficult one. But I think that there's also, I mean, you learn a lot from the military. I think that it offers a lot of opportunity to grow, not just in relationship to trauma, but in relationship to all the things that you do and the people that you meet and the challenges that you face.
Yeah, and I think there's even a chance for wisdom with seeing some of the difficult things and trying to respond and progress, perhaps.
Yeah.
So what are the things that we can do as civilians to help veterans in their transition back into our society?
There's a lot of different ways and a lot of different groups that are doing very good things. I think that it starts on an interpersonal level, right, with how you treat, you know, the veterans around you and how receptive you are to them. And then I also just think that kind of more generally, there's something about how we conceive of our relationship to war policy, which I think starts with us feeling a kind of accountability and responsibility for it, right? We like to blame things on politicians, but we have all have a role in you know, what we've been doing for the past 14 years. And I think that's very important.
So it's almost like we can honor the sacrifices that our soldiers make by at least participating in the conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And would you have any advice for your fellow veterans who are coming back and trying to adjust?
If there's anybody who's having difficulty adjusting, I think it's just a process. It takes time, and that's fine, right? For some people have more difficulty, there are resources. Certainly, it's making sure those resources are available to veterans is something, again, for all of us to try and ensure. But yeah, it's a process of moving into a different culture and a different world once you get out of the military.
Okay. Yeah, well thank you for sharing your thoughts on such a challenging topic like war and Iraq war in particular. Last question for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
I have no idea. Challenge me.
All right. And how would they do that?
By coming at me from an angle that I don't expect. I don't know. But that's the point, right? Push you out of your comfort zone.
Well, there you are. Well, thank you for pushing us out of our comfort zone and bringing this discussion to forefront. Those who want to learn more, where can they go to find out about you?
I've got a website, www.philkly.com.
Okay, fantastic. We'll put a link in our show notes for that. Well, enjoy the rest of your morning and week.
All right. Thank you. You too.
All right. So that's our interview with Phil Kly. Before expanding on some of the ideas we discussed, I wanted to take just a moment or two to share some thoughts I have about Chris Kyle, the decorated SEAL who was profiled in American Sniper. Like the rest of us, he's a complex guy with his strengths and weaknesses, but I do take issue with some of those who take cheap shots at him. I don't think Phil did that, but I just wanted to take a moment to defend him a bit since his name came up in our discussion. People say, well, you know, he is a racist because of the way he described the Iraqis he was fighting. All right, so he is talking about people who are trying to kill him and his friends and people he cares about. Some of them actually did do the screwdriver kind of torture that you saw in the film. That was a real event from what I heard. And so let's not have this kind of hypocrisy where we say, hey, we want our people to go out and kill and face these horrible things that most people don't have to face on a daily basis, and then get our feathers all ruffled when someone talks about the combatants in less than politically correct ways. That being said, Chris helped the Iraqi they codenamed Johnny Walker to get his book deal. Would you do that to someone if you despise their entire people? No, probably not. People have also criticized him or the American Sniper story for not including more nuances about the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and the Kurds. Sure, yeah, but I mean, it's not exactly like Chris Kyle was the scholar on Muslim relations and Muslim history. He's writing from a very specific perspective. There's only a limited amount of time to get everything across in a war story that's not so much about the sectarian differences as it is one man's experiences in the war. Chris is also the guy who downplays the number of kills he has in his book. Others like to talk about that more. And along those lines, it wasn't his idea to write the book. He was approached to do it. Whenever he's talking about those he killed, he's talking about them in context of protecting his soldiers, those he cares about, not in getting some kind of savage bloodlust out of killing people he despises. There's a difference. It seems like Chris did have some shortcomings, and the war took its toll. He was acknowledging his own struggles with anger and alcohol, even in his book. But at the end of his life, he was trying to help others in need. And for me, the deciding factor is the kind of impact he had on Taya. It seems like he really meant a lot to her. And there's something to be said about getting a sense of the person based on how those closest to him feel. It seems like he was a pillar of strength that helped her turn her own life around. So I'd like to see that get discussed more when he comes up. Anyway, this interview gave me the opportunity to think about the war genre in its different variations. Some of my favorite stories to read or see are war stories, films like Braveheart or Lawrence of Arabia, the war films of John Ford, and some of the classics like Saving Private Ryan or Sergeant York. And then there's the Why We Fight documentary series from the great Frank Capra. There's a film like Terrence Malick's A Thin Red Line, which manages to take all the chaos, noise, frenetic motion of war and turn it into distilled poetry. And if we expand the notion of what a war film can be or war story, then that even allows for a film like Casablanca to be in the mix. And that's probably one of my all-time favorites. George Lucas was referencing aerial pilot fighting from World War II in his Star Wars saga. And, you know, it's called Star Wars for a reason. We could even make a case that someone like J.R.R. Tolkien was writing war stories. Some would say that Lord of the Rings was Tolkien's justification and reworking of fighting in World War II distilled into fantasy. Interestingly enough, if you look up J.R.R. Tolkien's Wikipedia page, it's a picture of him in military attire. He fought in World War I and was a codebreaker in World War II, so it certainly influenced his outlook. And I think you could also make the argument that the Lord of the Rings influenced how the popular culture thinks about war, specifically World War II, as it being the good war producing the greatest generation, and so on. Other examples of more clear-cut written war stories that I enjoy, in addition to Phil's book and others that we mentioned, include one that I came across recently called The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers. Also a story about Iraq that manages to keep it a very intimate story about three friends. Going back a bit, there's Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, and even The Iliad, one of the earliest epic stories we have in literature, is also a war story. So the appeal of the genre is vast and goes all the way back to early civilizations. For me, those kinds of stories are compelling because they usually explore questions of what is and is not a just society and what kinds of things are worth fighting for. On the other hand, there are some war stories that I don't enjoy watching, like, say, Apocalypse Now. Not to say Apocalypse Now is a bad film or poorly made. It's a very well-made film, and it is worth watching. It's just not one I enjoy watching, and I would say that's probably because it is so focused on the heart of darkness in man. It is a literal retelling of Joseph Conrad's story, A Heart of Darkness, and it does explore the darker side of war of human nature. As I was suggesting in the interview with Phil, it's not that I don't acknowledge the existence of a darker side in humanity. It's that I know it all too well. I've grown up surrounded by it. I was teased extensively as a kid, and I would see how people who would be friendly in general situations would attack in a group context, as if the darkness in themselves was feeding off the darkness in others. As someone trying to get established in the film industry, I'm often dealing with petty people, conniving types with ulterior motives, people who seem to be friendly in one instance, but won't really stand up for you when it matters. So that takes its toll. It takes more effort to see the influence of something good at work than it does to see the disarray at large. And so for me, I gravitate towards the stories that help me see the possibility that goodness can prevail. I have my doubts, to be honest. That's not to say that I only watch shows that involve goodness on display. I did enjoy Breaking Bad and Mad Men, to give two examples, but those are interesting cases. In Breaking Bad, there's still a sense of a moral universe in that actions have consequences, and you get a sense that there is some kind of justice done to those who do bad things. It might take a while, but it comes eventually. For a show like Mad Men, it might seem at first to be dark and cynical, but it's actually more complicated than that. If you've seen the finale, you now have material that allows you to reevaluate the entire series and to find soulful moments and even optimistic moments. So there's a complexity there. It's not all darkness. On the other hand, it's not all darkness with a story like Apocalypse Now or stories like it, but it feels like darkness prevails, and those who do bad things aren't necessarily punished. It's just part of how the world works. That may very well be how the world works. It's certainly how it seems sometimes, but believing that makes it harder for me to engage the world in a meaningful way. Oh man, I will tell you, it seems sometimes that the podcast episodes I do relate in some way to things I'm going on in my life. And that's certainly been true here these past few days. Quite the mix of light and dark things in my world and even in my heart. Before going further, I want to say that I've never fought in a war. I'm not equating my experiences to the things that soldiers face. But I can relate, even in a small way, to experiencing difficult things that affect the decisions I make even years later. Phil Klei actually wrote an article talking about this sort of thing. He says he actually doesn't like it when people say, "I can't imagine what it was like for you all over there fighting." He points out that, well, many of us don't have combat experience. We still have difficult things that we faced that have affected our lives. And there's always going to be someone who has suffered more difficult things. So it's not a competition to see who has faced the worst things. It's about trying to find common ground to share in our humanity with each other. So to talk more about my experiences, I want to do that in context of our notion of moral strength. For whatever reason, we tend to think of that as a constant, that someone's moral nature or lack thereof is fixed in stone. Seems like a strange way to think of it. I mean, think about physical strength. If someone goes and runs 5 miles or 10 miles, does an intense workout, they're probably not going to be in the best shape that day to go into extensive combat, right? That's pretty clear. We get that. But I think it's also true about our moral strength. When we face one discouraging thing after another, and we don't get support from others, that eats away at our ability to do the right thing. We're all still responsible for our actions and the choices we make, but exhaustion in context of a moral issue is just as valid as exhaustion in a physical context. I am not a perfect person by any stretch of the imagination, but there are many days where I'm trying to have a positive impact. I'm making an effort. But lately, I faced one discouraging thing after another. Friends who I have helped in the past don't return calls or emails. They can't provide even the smallest gesture of support when it matters. I had a meeting with a certain type who presents himself as an ethical, religious type. He was actually one of the least considerate people I've dealt with in recent history. And I found out that he really screwed over someone I know in the past. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't just me being overly sensitive or imagining things that weren't there. To those of you who work hard and are able to see the returns of your efforts, I'm happy for you. Not my experience. The vast majority of the projects I work on, short films and so on, they usually don't make their money back. And something that I've worked on for weeks and months gets indifferent or malicious dismissal by someone who spent, you know, half an hour or less watching the short and making a throwaway comment that ends up discouraging me for days. I've tried to reach out to certain people in the industry who were at one point inspirational to me. Not only do they ignore my inquiries, they've resorted to mind games on occasion for whatever reason, I don't know. And these are the people whose own careers were made possible because others took a chance on them and gave them a break. By the way, if you're one of those people and you happen to be listening to this, I've been praying that you get exactly what you deserve. So if things aren't working out for you in certain areas, then maybe there's a reason for it. So if that's the case, maybe try to make amends or just make amends anyway and, you know, be a decent person. Okay, that kind of thing can happen, especially in the entertainment industry. But it seems like it keeps happening to me again and again and again in one variation or another. On top of that, there was a situation a few years ago where it felt like I should take certain actions. And it felt like doing so would be something good. That was my intention, to try to do something positive as a result. Because of that decision to try to do something good, to try to listen to that little prompt in my heart, it affected years of my life, demoralized me in ways that I can't even describe. And I would say probably made me less of an open-hearted person. And being an open-hearted person is something that's really important to me. All right, so this event, a variation of it, came up recently. And my knee-jerk reaction to the prospect of facing that again was to get as far away from it as possible. And it was lots of emotional ups and downs, let's say. Once again, though, it felt like this was something that I should do. It was the same sort of prompt I felt before. So as you might guess, I had a certain ambivalence about listening. And I fought with that thing, that sense, for a while. Eventually, though, I said, okay, I will try. It was a little late and, you know, things had changed a bit, but I said, okay, fine, I'll give it a shot. I'll listen and try and see what happens. And it went badly, pretty much as I expected, another discouraging thing that happened. And in response, I was pretty angry. And my inclination was to say, okay, you know what? I am so tired of trying to listen to that little whispering voice, that spark that tries to nudge me to better things, only to end up heartbroken and in the presence of phonies, narcissists, and sociopaths. So my inclination was, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I can to numb that sense, and I'm going to do whatever I want, regardless. That led to some less than stellar behavior on my part. I would say R-rated. And it's one of the reasons why this might not come out on time. We will see. Because I was trying to avoid doing this as well. And then I decided, no, I will still try and get it out because it has value. At least Phil's comments. Okay, well, what's the point of mentioning all this in a conversation about war stories? Well, if I have that kind of reaction to something that reminds me of a difficult situation from the past, and I was not involved in combat, what must it be like for the soldiers who face things that remind them of their combat experiences? Much harder, I'm sure, but I would imagine not entirely unrelated to the things I felt. Similarly, regarding the recent situation to which I alluded, if certain people had shown up or treated me in a different manner, and perhaps if the other person involved also didn't have certain experiences in the past, then, well, things might have gone otherwise. Who knows? And again, think about how much more true that must be for our soldiers. What kinds of lives could they lead? What kinds of decisions might they make if the rest of us are there to support them as they're trying to adjust? The way anyone reacts to a situation at hand is a function of not just who that person is, but also what he or she has faced in the past. And so we're depleting the potential of the future when we're not helping each other get past the experiences that prevent us from being the best versions of ourselves. Our soldiers face ugly and messy things on our behalf. We send them to war. We're a democracy, so we're all part of that decision in one way or another. And so the least we can do is support them in their efforts to get past those traumas when they return home. This is something I've spent some time thinking about as I've been working on and developing Trench War, a short film I directed about a soldier battling post-traumatic stress. A lot of people talk about supporting the troops in general, but they're hesitant to go beyond the platitudes, especially if that means facing something messy or complex. I was listening to an episode of The Art of Charm, and they were talking about this. They had veteran John Davis as a guest. He is a Marine sergeant who fought in Iraq, and he was talking about how some businesses will say that they support the troops, but they're hesitant to hire veterans. And so he had this great quote that I wanted to read to you. I really imagine that if you're not going to hire a veteran because you think he's going to shoot people in the office, that's just as bad as not hiring a black person because he's probably in a gang. The vast majority of veterans who battle PTSD are not going to harm others. If anything, they might be more inclined to harm themselves. And even then, that's not something that always happens. Yes, it might be a little messy to hire someone with combat experience. Perhaps he or she is still trying to resolve the issues that came up from combat. But as they mention in that Art of Charm episode, there's also lots of benefits. People who are used to getting things done, who are very mission-oriented, who are trained to be respectful to others, to accept authority and work within its framework. A lot of advantages to bringing on veterans, but again, some messiness, some complexity there. But you know, I think that's true for all of us, if we're honest. There's something to be said for simplicity sometimes. And simplicity is certainly a factor when selling. When you want to sell to a lot of people, make it as simple as possible. But if you really want to get a sense of what other people are like, you need some complexity there. We're all some kind of mixture of light and dark, good and evil, if you will. Remember earlier I mentioned that Braveheart was one of the war stories I really admire. And that's true, even though Mel Gibson has said some things that I find rather distasteful. But then on the other hand, to dismiss him outright for a few things he said is not a balanced view of things. It's trying to put a simple label on a complex person. There's a historical fiction novel about the Civil War written by Michael Shera called Killer Angels. And I think that phrase sums it up nicely, that we as people are some strange, almost paradoxical mix of killers and angels. And there's an ongoing struggle to see which one will prevail in our hearts. As a coda to my commentary here, I want to mention something that happened on my flight back from Virginia on the early evening of May 22nd. I was coming back from about a week's worth of training at Cannon, and a few hours before my flight back, it felt like I should change my seat. It wasn't just something out of convenience, but something that I should do, similar to the feeling I had in those other situations that I mentioned. So I changed it to seat 12D. It's an emergency exit, so I'd have more leg room. Plus, the number 12 has special significance to me. I was born on June 12th, for one thing. So all those things, but it felt right for whatever reason. As it happened, I ended up sitting next to a Catholic seminary student, and we had a pretty meaningful conversation, as much as you can have on a short flight. At the time, I interpreted that as an indication that things would work out in my favor. But, you know, things didn't go as planned. Looking back, though, it was a comforting experience. He was one of the most sincere spiritual people I've encountered in recent history, and that really meant a lot. I was still angry about some of the things that happened, but having that conversation helped me to have this conversation here. My encounter in seat 12D brought to mind the 12 short stories in Phil Klee's book, Redeployment, specifically the story entitled Prayer in the Furnace. In it, a chaplain reflects on his unanswered prayers about ending suffering in the war, and he concludes that prayer isn't always about getting the answers we want, but about knowing that someone is there going through the suffering with us. And so you see, it's complicated, and there's light and darkness through and through. Whether a heart of darkness or a heart of light prevails in me, I don't know. It's too close to call, to be honest. if you have a preference for one direction or another, you could always lend a hand to me or to anyone, really. Now's as good of a time to do that as any. I'm just saying. Okay, well, that's our show. If you like the show, would you take a moment to support our efforts? I know a number of you listen. If just a small percent of you would take the time to share or write a comment, would do a lot to help us grow and to continue to do what we're doing in a bigger, more interesting way. So thank you for considering that. Thanks again to LA Film Prize for sponsoring this episode. You know, it's not too late to put together a film and submit your rough cut before the deadline of July 14th, before midnight. Still have some time. You got to get on it. LAFilmPrize.com is the site. Discount code is NSAVIDES1. It's the number one. So NSAVIDES1 gets you 50% off registration. So give it a shot. Only stipulation is you have to shoot in Northwest Louisiana to be eligible. It's manageable. We mentioned Terrence Malick earlier. Well, there's a film, Ain't Them Bodies Saints, which has a Terrence Malick feel to it in its lyrical style. That was shot in Northwest Louisiana in Shreveport. Well, maybe that's not your style. Maybe you'd rather imitate the occasional peddler of despair himself, Mr. Stephen King. Well, the Mist film, based on Stephen King's novella of the same name, was also shot in Shreveport. So lots of possibilities for you. Whatever possibility you want to go, head over to LAFilmPrize.com to get the process started. Speaking of light and dark possibilities, music from the show comes from Rob Koslow's song, True Gemini. Thank you very much for that. To all the men and women who serve in the armed forces on our behalf, thank you very much for your service. I will do what I can to honor your sacrifices through the way I live my life and take advantage of the freedoms you allow. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.